From Airwolf, Magnum PI, and Saint Elsewhere, Native Voices and Days of Our Lives, this is Jean Bruce Scott congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this station and podcast.
Well, 'tis the season for sniffs and snuffles to go through. No, it's not December again. It's not October. It's not autumn and so on. It's spring, and of course it's hay fever. And as we look at the top 25 worst hay fever hotspots, clearly we are in need of an ace pharmacist to sort things out with respect to that. So we're delighted to be able to turn to regional pharmacist extraordinaire Rachel Sharples. Good morning, Rachel. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
This seems to have become certainly something which each year becomes more and more of a challenge for people in terms of hay fever and really people suffering quite badly about it.
That's true. We've certainly seen this year a huge increase in the numbers of people that are seeking treatments for hay fever. And particularly, it's in towns and cities, which is quite interesting. Not what you may expect.
Well, the top worst hay fever hotspots, I mean, the top five, got Manchester, Plymouth, London, Leeds and Nottingham. Neither of those places, or none of those places, are really renowned, as you say, for their high pollen count. So is it a case of particulates in the city? I mean, I thought our cities were getting cleaner and less pollution-filled.
Yeah, I mean, our cities are certainly getting cleaner, or so we think. What we do still have, though, is obviously quite high levels of pollution. And what we suspect is that when we've got these high levels of pollution, the particles within the pollution give the pollen something to attach onto. And that means that perhaps the pollen isn't moved out of the air as quickly as it would be otherwise.
It's also something that we've noted with some of our students at the University of Lincoln, of course, that you don't have to actually have had hay fever as a child. It can develop literally at any time in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people can go their whole life without suffering from hay fever symptoms and then all of a sudden find that they are suffering. As with any allergies, you don't necessarily have to have suffered them from the before and all of a sudden you can start with these symptoms. The good news with hay fever is that for most people, the symptoms can be managed very effectively with over-the-counter remedies.
Well, this, of course, is the classic thing, because people are beginning to realise just how important the pharmacists can actually be, rather than actually booking time out to see people in other aspects of the health services and so on. First of all, how do you tell if you've got either hay fever or you've got a cold? Is it all to do with sneezy symptoms and so on?
Yeah, you need to look at the types of symptoms that you're suffering from. So if you've got hay fever, you tend to find that you've got very itchy, perhaps watery eyes, and you'll more than likely have a runny nose. But that discharge will be very watery and clear. Whereas if it's a cold that you're suffering from, your runny nose will usually be accompanied by some other symptoms, perhaps a sore throat, perhaps a cough, or you may feel tired or headachy. And if you do have a discharge from your nose, it's more likely to be coloured. So that's a really good way to tell the difference between hay fever and a common cold. And it's also the duration of the symptoms. So hay fever tends to go on, whereas obviously a cold will resolve itself within a few days or a couple of weeks.
It's always great sympathy for students who are actually taking exams at this period, because clearly you need to look at how that sort of can impact and affect on folk. How can people, I mean, is it best to go for nasal sprays? What are the key ways in which we can actually cope and manage the symptoms of hay fever?
So there are lots of over-the-counter remedies that you can purchase from pharmacies. The best thing to do really is to pop into a pharmacy. We've got 780 branches across the country, still known as the Cooperative Pharmacy, although we have changed our name to Well. So pop in, have a word with the pharmacist, and they'll be able to advise the appropriate treatment for your symptoms. Generally speaking, an antihistamine in a tablet form will control most symptoms for most people. If you do find you're suffering particularly with those nasal symptoms, though, then you might want to add in a nasal spray. Likewise, if it's your eyes that are particularly causing the problem for you, then there's lots and lots of eye drops that you could use as well to help control those symptoms.
In terms of obviously what you see in as part of the Well group and so on, have you noticed a particular increase, or is it kind of anecdotal evidence that people are kind of going down with hay fever more frequently than they used to, for instance?
Yeah, what we've done is look at the sales of the hay fever products from our branches, and we've seen a huge increase. It's a 67% increase that we've noted this year, based year-on-year increase. So that's a huge increase in the numbers of people that are seeking treatment.
For those people who are looking to take a holiday and so on, is that something? Clearly hay fever can often depend on the types of pollen. There are lots sorts of different pollens that are around. Some folk have actually said you should be using honey and honey from bees from the area that it's actually found to cure the whole thing. Are there kind of international areas where you'd actually say, well, if you're heading off to Cyprus, for instance, you need to have that particular solution. If you're going off to Brazil, you need something completely different.
It really just depends on patient choice in terms of the treatment that you'd prefer to use. Certainly an antihistamine would be the first line treatment for hay fever, so that's not necessarily area dependent. It's really just the patient's choice as to whether a tablet's more convenient or a liquid more convenient, or perhaps whether they prefer to use a nasal spray or eye drops.
And in terms of well pharmacy, do you find that many of the actual pharmacists themselves, they also have to sort of look after themselves in terms of hay fever? I mean, presumably there'll be some staff who'll be suffering equally along with their customers.
Absolutely. Well, we estimate it's about 1 in 5 people that suffer from hay fever. So 1 in 5 in the general population, that's a fair amount of our pharmacists as well.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it can impact people in their day-to-day lives, particularly if they're working or, like you say, sitting exams. So it really is key to control those symptoms.
So people have been listening to this particular little piece and think, oh, fine, OK, where do we go? Is there a where, do you go to the Well pharmacist site? How can people find out more details?
Yeah, you can go to our website, which is www.pharmacy.co.uk. Or, like I say, pop into one of our branches. Our teams are always on hand to offer expert advice. Or you can also look on the NHS Choices website. There's some brilliant information on there to help people manage their symptoms.
There we are. So you have Well Pharmacy Data, of course, formerly the cooperative. As ever, Rachel, we knew you wouldn't let us down. You'd actually sort of nail the sort of issues so that those pesky pollen areas and the mucous membranes can be sorted through and people can actually inhale and exhale comfortably without the sort of runny noses and all the rest of the bits and pieces that go along with that. Rachel, it's been fabulous touching base with your good self. Have you had a reasonably interesting and hopefully pollen-free, or relatively pollen-free, or sneeze-free telephonic link with us this morning?
It's been fantastic. Thank you very much for chatting to me.
Excellent, Rachel Sharples. We salute you, regional pharmacist extraordinaire. Take care now. Led to Avengers Age of Ultron possibly, you know, opening up the only way we could actually welcome Richard Fitzwilliams to the studio. How are you, Richard?
I'm on Kate Wait, Baby Watch. I can do almost nothing.
No.
I think you don't know where...
Richard, you're not having the child. You know, you're not having the baby. It's you know, the Duchess of Cambridge.
Right, you are. But the trouble is, of course, that you have to be in the right place. When the pregnancy of George was announced early, as you will remember, I was in Berlin, no Wi-Fi, but if you're in the tube, if you're in a sports club practicing, if you're not where...
If you're getting on with your own life, for instance, as opposed to having an unhealthy obsession with the royals, you'll be in all sorts of difficulties.
What an unkind thing to say.
It is.
I think I'll have a word with Ultron.
Yeah.
I think that he'll sort out such muddled thoughts.
I know, is that. However, will the royal baby influence the election? I don't know. Jared Johnson, what do you think? Will the royal baby influence the election?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it'll even get much coverage, to
See,
be honest.
Whoa.
Dangerous
words.
What I should say is it shouldn't
why
do.
Why you believe that firstly, by inference, the election, can I just explain what I meant? When you've got an electorate, according to the Mail, right or wrong, there are 40% of people who haven't made up their mind. It's a hell of a percentage, but even if it was half that, you've got a very large number of marginal seats. In the marginals, not the others, the election's going to be decided. If you've got those, and remember the disillusion with the main parties, the splinter parties, all the rest of it, the fact that individuals, a lot of them, decide only very, very late where to put their cross. The fact some might decide or feel disillusioned or not want to vote at all. If you have, say, and we don't know when the baby's going to be born, perhaps hypothetically, say, 2 or 3 days before the election. I mean, I just don't mean that they'd hear the gun salutes or the church bells personally, but they might see Big Ben lit up. They might just get the feel of a certain amount of joyousness, which there always is, as there is at the birth of any baby. And a royal baby is obviously one which is very big news. Believe me, I mean, if it's born on instantly before the election, you could just imagine how they're going to have trouble fitting it in the news. I do agree that there would be a certain problem. But if you remember what happened before, that has been handled much better this time. We won't have the big Kate wait with hundreds of camera crew and crews are opposite. But what my point is, you would have, even if it's just a relatively few people, feel perhaps that life wasn't so bad, perhaps return to old allegiances. The tradition, the convention, who knows whether it's right or not, is if something goes well just before an election, it's supposed to benefit the party or parties in power. But my point is, a few people might change their minds, maybe quite a few, and they might vote, which they hadn't decided to, or they might, as I say, return to old allegiances or whatever, and that could, in certain seats, it's so close, not Scotland, but in England, certainly, change.
I mean, you might as well just say, it's ridiculous. Jessica Ward, your thoughts? I mean, baby bounce, was it going to create, could it just swing you one side or the other? Obviously, we don't want to know where, because I can't go into that sort of political bias at this stage, but would you be influenced by their new arrival?
No, I think, I don't have any, opinions about
it. There we
are.
See, and that's the view of our New Zealand correspondents.
Well, I would hope so, because I don't think that, I know which way I'm going to vote, but you would know probably.
I might have a suggestion, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Of course not, I'm asking you to comment. Exactly. Would I do such a thing? I mean, such mischief abroad. I believe Ultron has, in fact, influenced, because Ultron's a former Frankenstein-like figure, and I think he's had an influence today.
We had major discussions last night on the show with Phil Leonis, who hasn't seen it as yet, even though he's based in Los Angeles. He's too busy, obviously, with the final cut of his own movie, The Lady Killers, and that's going to be a classic, I've no doubt. Emma Tinson had, of course, seen it and checked it out over the weekend. I'd also sort of take the opportunity to go and see it. I came away thinking, well, very good, but I'd give it a 9 as opposed to a 10. I mean, I felt that there were other areas like Captain America, Winter Soldier, the first Avengers movie, which slightly sort of tipped the balance. Jared, have you seen it as yet?
No, but a lot of my friends have been and seen it, and they've certainly, you know, been posting on Facebook and other
positive,
really positive, very positive. Very positive.
Jessica,
same with me. A lot of positive comments on Facebook.
Lots of positive, but obviously, you know, we can have all the Facebook social media things going through. You have your Twitter, you can have your Instagrams, etc. Clearly, the world awaits, just as we wait for a royal baby, for the views for Richard Fitzwilliams. So,
well, I simply have to say that it's one that will please the fans. I mean, that is the main thing, to please your fan base, because the fan base for the Avengers movies, it's absolutely vast. And what has impressed me is the box office. It's been amazing. We know tickets are much more expensive in the days that either Gone with the Wind or Titanic, in real terms, all the rest of it, if you look at it in that way, it's not quite as phenomenal. But my goodness me, it's a goldmine. I mean, you've got this wonderful idea of having a selection of characters that you picked from various periods in history, or a scientist turning into monsters or whatever in The Incredible Hulk. And you've got top actors, including Robert Downey Jr. Everyone likes his wisecracks. But I would make the point that I did find, in fact, both the films we're talking about today, I found more than enough in it that was being a bit mumbled. I do wish that they'd, sometimes on stage too, you know, you'd have stronger voices. Having said that, it's one that it's a crowd pleaser. As for the 9 out of 10, I mean, I'd go for the 8 out of 10, but and for personally, for 7.5 out of 10. It's a thoroughly enjoyable. It's colourful. It's pacey, and it's got pretty well everything those who go and see these sort of movies are looking for. It's also got colourful set pieces, and the action sequences, certainly this time round, are I thought rather successful. Although the numbers of Ultron's robots that are dispatched, I mean,
huge,
I haven't seen so many
since
Where Eagles Dare. A number of Germans not shot, but I mean, you've got something that's working, and it does.
Well, interesting line from that perspective. Did you see it in 3D, Richard, or did you just...
No, I didn't. You know, for me, 3D is... It's a frippery. I mean, I see it in 3D if I'm...
Forced to.
If I'm at a preview, possibly in 3D, but it doesn't make any difference. I mean, occasionally, just occasionally, I mean, I give a nod to, say, Hugo, Great Gatsby... didn't really in this respect. I mean, very few movies really have benefited from 3D. There are certain sequences that you have butterflies, or you have strange things thrusting out at you, or spears being thrown.
That happens every time we do these shows, Richard. So that's a minor sort of thing, really.
Well, very minor. I mean, Ultron. But I mean, I'm not sure that James Spader as Ultron. One of the problems with a lot of these movies is that you've really got to have an absolutely marvelous villain. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where some of the Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man movies, in my view, went wrong. It's because it's very difficult to create them. So
you're saying that Alfred Molina as Dr. Octopus didn't quite cut the mustard?
That was what I was thinking of. It was really bad. I mean, it really was. I mean, it in fact is so bad that it has etched itself on your soul. Yeah. I can see that.
Well, I put it in the same league of quality as Nicole Kidman's singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in Australia, another classic of our time.
I'm
speechless, aren't you, Richard?
I am. You know, two of the most terrible sounds for a length of what, Over the Rainbow, perhaps what, 2.5 minutes that I've heard in my life. Yeah. Margaret Beckett, the Labour politician, former Labour politician now, singing for charity. There is a house in New Orleans, and the one you've just mentioned, Nicole Kidman singing.
Let's get them both together, Margaret Beckett and Nicole Kidman. It's got to be a winner.
What a good idea. That was what Ultron would think. I mean, they really are a tax.
Quick, Jessica, get Ed Miliband on the case. It could be a winner, you know.
Well, I mean, you add Russell Brand as well and get him to sing, you think.
Yes.
No, probably not.
So, a disgraced member of the military police investigates a series of nasty child murders during the Stalin-era Soviet Union. It's not Child 2, because obviously that would be Royal Family, but it's Child 44.
It's Child 44, and the plot of this movie, I mean, this is absolutely fascinating, the fact that as we're constantly reminded, in Stalinist Russia in the 50s, while Stalin denied that there could be murder, let alone serial killers.
He denied quite a lot, actually, Richard, in fairness.
Yes, he did, actually. You're right there. You're right there. You're absolutely right there. And he said that there could be no murder in paradise as a result. When children start disappearing and being murdered, well, in theory, they couldn't be. And that presents a problem, especially for Leo Demidov, played by Tom Hardy. He's a security agent. He becomes disgraced. And also for problems for Noomi Rapace as Raisa, his wife. They are, in fact, exiled from Moscow. That's a pretty grim thing when it happens to you. To a district which is run by General Nesterov, the best performance in the film given by Gary Oldman. And here again, a series of child murders are taking place. And what occurs when the husband and wife detective team attempt to track them down and when they're being observed. And I mean, the concept of this is superb because we really see the monstrous totalitarian state that was Stalinist Russia. They've got the grime, they've got, my goodness, they've got so much mud. I mean, the trouble with the mud is that it seems to have got in the crevices of the ears, the eyes, and the thoughts of those making this film, because there are several, it's such a shame. This could have been and should have been a really chilling movie, because they've spent so much on the backgrounds, and background yet is not foreground, it is not scripted, it is not giving a succession of excellent performers, including Vincent Cassell, Charles Dance, and so on. They all have extraordinary accents, which sounds silly. Sweet Francais has had this problem. And
when
also,
you say extraordinary, is it extraordinary in the same way Sean Connery's Russian accent in Hunt for Red October was quite bizarre in its own routine?
Yes, that sort of thing. Oh, I mean, you know, we're thinking of there are a few notorious ones, Dick Van Dyke's
classic.
Mary Poppins, Sean Connery's Irish policeman in The Untouchables, Michael Caine in the Cider House Rules. There are a few, but this is the problem with this movie is that they all speak in this strange, it almost becomes a form of slang, but the difficulty, the real problem, is that you can't hear a lot of it. And the other difficulty is that it's a very contrived movie. It's far too long, and I hate to say it, with a theme like this, it actually is extremely dull. It's as dull as a Stalinist propaganda movie for the most part, and my goodness me, sitting through one of those must have been hell. I've actually have, in the Russian embassy before the Cold War ended, as editor of International Who's Who, I went to a movie which extolled the hero of the Second World War, Marshal Zhukov. But it was really all about, or a lot of it was about Stalin. My goodness me, it was ghastly. So, I mean, here you've got a real missed opportunity. You've got all the background that you need, all the trouble spent on that, and what you also got, Vincent Cassell popping up at odd times in scenes where he wouldn't. It's a contrived film, and also it's a dull one, and the potential here, which is enormous, just simply isn't realised.
It's only 2 hours 17 minutes long.
Yes, I know. You feel.
I mean, that's just 17 minutes longer than one of these shows. Don't say anything, Richard, for goodness sakes. But according to Variety magazine, Tom Hardy, Gary Oldman thriller, Child 44, a disaster at the box office.
It shouldn't have been. Well, of course, a disaster at the box office. I mean, the trouble is you're going to persuade people to look at grim, depressing images. But had the film, which was after all about a chilling, terrible series of murders in real life and a subject that, you know, Stalinist repression, I mean, it's a theme that does provoke or should provoke thought, but if you're bored, you think about escape when the film's ending.
Let's look at the figures for the financial folk up there. The moody thriller about the search for a serial killer in Soviet Russia earned a paltry $600,000 domestically. That's barely enough to get Jessica Ward out of bed in the morning, for goodness sakes. $600,000 domestically in its opening weekend, and a meagre $2.1 million internationally.
Oh, that is a catastrophe, but the reason
it costs nearly $50 million to produce.
Yes, because the backgrounds are absolutely superb. You look at a Moscow railway station and you see it as much as it must have been, and producing that with extras, hundreds of them, I mean, you've got the grime, you've got that's ghastly weather, the mud, there really is almost too much mud, what goes on with fighting in the mud and so on. Again, you've got a movie that is a thriller. It has to be pacey and have to create interest, but also you've got to understand what the people are saying. So, I mean, there's no point in just mentioning an excellent cast and going on about that.
You can have subtitles when it's released on DVD. Surely that's going to help.
Subtitles. Now, there's a thought. Yeah. The trouble is, you have to cut that 2 hours and 17 minutes.
Yeah, okay, final word. A movie that offers up plenty of Russian accents. What's not to love? Pre-perestroika official corruption and a high pre-teen body count is a difficult sell in any circumstances.
Well, the answer is to go to Leviathan. Now, there is a movie which exposes the corruption at the heart of Putin's Russia. There's a movie that was nominated for an Oscar, and there is a movie that I would recommend, and its length, I think it was about 2.5 hours at least, and I mean, superlative performances, gripping.
So you'd say,
I mean, you've got Putin's Russia compared to a former beached whale, which is on the poster of this movie. And if you're thinking of looking at Russia, look at Leviathan.
Okay, so presumably then, as far as the households of Christian Bale and Leonardo DiCaprio, who were originally sort of likely to be connected with Channel 44 before Tom Hardy stepped into place, they'd be sort of going, yeah, well, good decision. But will you go and see it, Jared?
I'll take Richard's advice and watch something more interesting, I think.
Ooh. Jessica?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, I'll give it that, but by what Richard has said, it hasn't really sparked any interest.
I'm not going to make much money back.
I trust Richard.
Well, I'm afraid it's a bore, and I wish I didn't have to say and reiterate that, but I'm trying to save you. I mean, firstly, you won't understand a great deal of what they're saying, and secondly, you won't appreciate what you're
saying. Look, they're undergraduates. It's a part of a matter of their life. They don't understand what people say. They go to these places. What are they being said? People are just talking at them for a period of time. Goodness me.
Well, the trouble is, one shouldn't. I mean, it really, based on a true story, It was a movie that really had potential. It should have been excellent. And you also got Gary Oldman alone is able to carve out a certain integrity. Of course, Rapace and Hardy, I mean, they do their best, but doing your best is not good enough because, as you've mentioned, the fateful 2 hours, 17 minutes, all that mud and grime and whatever, and it's not making much sense because it isn't interesting enough. That's fatal for a thriller.
Never mind. They could have actually sort of bitten the bullet and actually gone for something like Chuck Norris or possibly I don't know, Jean-Claude Van Damme to actually sort of take on the role.
It wasn't a question of the actors.
Was
what
it?
You need. No, it's a question of the way it's directed. It's the pace, fateful, and, well, yes, the accent.
Okay.
Too,
so, it's thumbs up to
You've
Avengers
done your
Age of
best
Ultron.
To save it. It's a thumbs up for, well, Ultron. That's a movie that's going
even
to...
Even though, Richard, not a spoiler here, but tragically, no real major trailer tapped onto the end. Just literally, the Avengers will return. Not good enough.
When you mention the word trailer or teaser for trailer or whatever,
I know,
there's
you,
been a lot
you,
of debate
put
about
your finger
it.
Is
I
in
have
you.
To say that... I was just pausing in front of one, in front of a cinema, and it just absolutely shocks me the amount trailers give away. The magic, the surprise...
It's attention spans, you know. If we can't sit through a 2-hour, 17-minute movie, you've got to get it all encapsulated in 2 to 3 minutes. End off.
It's QED, there you have it. I mean, who would argue with that? Not even Pythagoras.
Well, and he knew where the square of his hypotenuse was located. Jessica... Last question. Obviously, the next thing is Baby Watch, which I'm sure we'll be sort of working through. And I'm sure it'll go splendidly. That's the important thing, whatever the sort of day of final arrival. But what are the last two questions we need to put to Richard Fitzwilliams now?
Okay, Richard, have you enjoyed the midweek drive this morning?
I've enjoyed it indeed, but I did not enjoy all of what we discussed. I've been with Child 44, so, you know, you've been warned.
Never mind. I mean, at least we can look forward to very shortly a Royal Night Out, which is going to be a classic.
Exactly.
It's going to be memorable, but more than that, I can't say. You know perfectly well you're being mischievous. You know I had to sign an embargo notice, but I thought...
Okay, and the next question, Jessica, is...
Will we hear from
it's
you
early
in the near
morning.
Future? That's it.
Yeah. He's coming back, hopefully. Richard, you will return, won't you?
Oh, I will indeed, most emphatically. We've got far from the Manning crowd to catch up to.
Of oneself is one of the most terrifying experiences you can go through, particularly if you're also losing parts of a loved one in terms of their mental capabilities and so on. We're of course referring to some
the tragedy that in many ways is dementia. Approximately 850,000 people are currently living with dementia in the UK. And to address these issues and hopefully sort of put some hope to the fore, we're delighted to welcome broadcast extraordinaire, of course, the legendary Angela Rippon, OBE.
Good morning, Alex. It's good to talk to you again.
Likewise. And from the head of care of clinical services for the UK, Pauline Houchin. How are you, Pauline?
Good, thank you. Good morning.
Excellent. Angela, if we can come to you first, because you have personal experience of this whole situation with respect to dementia with your own mother, of course.
Very much so, yes. My late mother, Edna, was diagnosed with dementia in 2003. And like an awful lot of people who suddenly find that someone in their family has been diagnosed with this illness, I knew nothing at all about it. So I had to go through a very sharp learning curve, as do most families. And I became, I think, as a result of that, an ambassador for the Alzheimer's Society. And for me, that was a great place to start because they gave me so much information about what the illness involved, what was likely to happen to my mum as it progressed, and also gave me tips on how I should actually live with her and deal with her as those different things manifested themselves, as she lost all sense of time, as she became someone who would one minute be very sweet and charming and the next minute absolute hell on wheels, you know, because she would get sort of temper, she would get frustrated, she would get she would feel very, very agitated because she wasn't understanding what was happening to her. And eventually she started to become quite agoraphobic. But, you know, one of the most important things that I discovered was, through the Alzheimer's Society, that it is possible for people with dementia to live well with that condition within society, providing the whole family, if it is the family that is going to care for your loved one, they all rally round and all take a part and all recognise that actually you can live well with the condition, and that one of the most important things for people who are diagnosed with dementia is to feel that regardless of their illness, they are still an important member of your family and an important member of their society and local community. And in my mum's case, because she lived in a small village on the edge of Dartmoor in Devon, I made sure that her friends kept in touch with her by telephone or would come and take her out on day trips. That every Friday, the local pub, which was a very short walk away, had a wonderful carvery lunch, very, very inexpensive. But it was a great opportunity for my mum and some of her friends to go and have lunch together and talk. And they engaged my mum and made sure that she was still stimulated. I would take her shopping from time to time. And I would always try and find some reason to get her out of the house and do something. Because two of the great fears of people with Alzheimer's and dementia is that they will become isolated and lonely as society kind of draws away from them. And actually, you must have completely the opposite effect, that they really do need to still be supported by their friends. They do still need people to recognise that actually having dementia doesn't mean to say that you've got to be stuck at home and never go anywhere, but that you still want to be a part of society. You want to go out and you know, if you're a bloke, you want to go to the local football team. You want to go to the pub with your mates. And you know, if you're a woman, you might still want to go and have your hair done, go on shopping trips, whatever. It's really important that families recognise how essential it is really to get out and about so that your loved one is constantly stimulated and constantly feels that they are important and a valued member of the family and their local community.
Makes eminent sense. Pauline, if we can turn to you from your own perspective, this, again, eminently sensible solution, or at least a way of coping with the situation, is this something you would heartily endorse?
Absolutely. Care UK's research has shown that in Lincoln and the surrounding areas, a huge 84% of people would not feel confident to take a loved one who's living with dementia on a trip out. So Care UK's Good to Go guide is a really practical guide full of practical hints and tips about making yourself more confident to enable you to do that so that you can still be part of your local community. It talks about the planning of trips out. You know, trips out do not have to be an all-day event. It can be something as simple as taking your loved one to a local park, having a sandwich picnic lunch on a park bench, and then walking home again. And that's a really good outing if you're not feeling confident to begin with as a first step, and actually can create some magical moments for you and your loved one, just to feel the wind in your hair, the sun on your face. We all know that being outside can be emotionally, physically really good for you, but can also be really spiritually uplifting. And it's really important that you make those magic moments with your loved one.
I think it's important to say, isn't it, Pauline, that this little booklet is made up of experiences from people who are carers and who have dementia themselves. And so, it really, Alex, comes from the experts. These are people who really do know what they're talking about, because, you know, they've probably been through the mill and they've been through the experience of thinking, oh, I've organised something wonderful for my loved one today, and then the loved one has said, no, I'm not going out, thank you very much indeed. And so, it tells you then how to cope with that kind of thing. So it's not just, you know, a load of academics that have sat down and written this. These are the people who are the experts in dementia, because they're carers and people who live with the condition themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, there are three very good friends, former friends of the station, who sadly suffered the condition. We had Ali McLeod, the former Scottish manager. We had Jamie Anderson's father, of course, Gerry Anderson, the late Gerry Anderson, who was a very high-profile case. And indeed, Bob Holness, who also sort of went for the whole thing. And is it the fear, do you think, that that's something which perhaps actually it's important that people do not just cope with this whole thing, but recognise and acknowledge it, and again, start putting into place some of these very eminently practical suggestions?
Very much so. I mean, I think an awful lot of people are still very much afraid of dementia, which is why it's all the more important that those people who are living with the illness and their families, their carers, their loved ones, are out in the community. Because, you know, you will know, Alex, that I know lots and lots of people through my work with the Alzheimer's Society. You know, I am very heavily involved in our work on dementia. The people that I meet who are living with dementia, you have perfectly normal conversations with them. They're people, you know, they go to the theatre, they go to the cinema, they come out. There are a number of people with dementia who are our ambassadors, who are out talking in schools, talking to local communities, talking at the Women's Institute, talking to people about what it means to live with dementia. And very often, people in the audience will say, well, I didn't realise, you know, that you could still be so lucid, that you could still be so active and involved in the community. So really, it is important that those people with dementia and their carers are out in the community to help take away some of the fear, because by example you're able to see that you really can live well with the condition. And yes, of course, people are afraid of it, because as we all know, there is no cure for it, but there are ways of mitigating the worst effects of dementia. There's Aricept, for instance, which is one of the drugs which is available, but also getting out, exercising. As Pauline was saying, fresh air, just that wonderful sort of stimulation of being able to talk with friends still. Go to the local museum and look at things that remind you of things that were important in your past. Go, you know, we've got, for instance, on a national level, Lord's Cricket Ground, which is going to be quite determined to be the first dementia-friendly sports arena in the country, because it has that fabulous cricket museum and it opens it to people with dementia so that they can go in and look at the old portraits, look at some of the old cricket bats and the cricket balls and the equipment and the photographs of people and videos of games that were played. What wonderful way to stimulate memories if you go to your local museum, if you go to your local football club or whatever, and just, or even come to the university and be stimulated still. And I think the more and more that people see that you can live well with this condition for many, many years, that is going to help to take away a lot of the fear. And the other thing is, of course, we're all talking about it now. You will know that 10 years ago, dementia was one of those things that people really didn't talk about publicly. But, you know, Pauline and I are here now. You're talking about it, Alex. People in your community, in Lincoln, where you've got dementia-friendly businesses, you've got dementia friends, you've got all sorts of people who are now much more aware of dementia, and that is all helping, not to perhaps for everyone to take away the fear, but certainly to diminish the amount of fear that people have of the illness and realise that it is something that can be managed.
Indeed. In fact, this interview will be going out as part of our dementia awareness campaign we're running on the Siren Lifestyle programme. So it just goes to show.
Well done, you.
Aspect. Well, very important. As well, East Midlands Radio Station of the Year, of course, for the second year running.
Yes.
Moving on, finally, in terms of KUK, Pauline, what's the best website people can go to actually find out information, more information about what we've been speaking about on the programme so far?
So you can go on to kuk.com/goodtogo, or you can pick up a hard copy of the booklet at your local KUK care home.
And can I also say that if you go to that website, there's a wonderful video of people who are carers, people talking about this and really sort of condensing, giving you a wonderful précis of what is in the book. So if you're a bit nervous of downloading the book, just look at the video and that'll give an awful lot of people terrific confidence, won't it, Pauline?
Absolutely.
Angela, as ever, you maintain the double Q quality and a quirkiness and just general overall wonderment, which is fantastic stuff. Angela Rippon, OBE, and of course, KUK's Head of Care and Clinical Services, Pauline Hatchin. Many thanks indeed. We will speak again, I'm sure, very soon.
Thank you. Thanks, Alex.
Passion. That's always what I like about Angela Ruffin. She always has such passion for the whole thing. Excellent stuff. So, Jared Johnson and Jessica Ward, some heart-rending thoughts there from that perspective.
Yeah.
But interesting sort of line. I mean, Jessica, you just had an experience as part of your restaurant work, basically.
Yes.
You weren't sure whether somebody just came in, ordered a £60 meal, then walked off again, eventually.
Yep. And then we eventually found out he had dementia, and my manager was persistently asking him to pay and he wasn't answering, and then he felt very guilty when he found out.
Well, it all works splendidly, which is something I've been consistently saying before we actually turn to our next guest, who really deserves a full mega introduction, such as yes, Elmer Bernstein there with something that Newcastle have been striving to do for years, since the 70s, seven consecutive defeats. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yes, John Carver has done the business, hasn't he, Ian Lennox?
Well, he has.
Sensational.
Does that make you feel better, Alan?
I just say, surely, you know, he's going to work on that. And, of course, the eighth one is in sight. You know, it's tremendous stuff from that point of view.
Yeah, and you've just clinched the league title for a second year. No, you haven't, have you? No. I've got dementia.
Steady on, sir. You know, at least we're top four. That's the important thing. Thanks, of course, to Hull City for doing the business, and indeed Everton. So well done, Hull City. Well done, Everton. That's what we like to say. And also well done to the Magnificent Seven. John Carver obviously has a bit of a track record in terms of obviously being assistant to Alan Shearer, and we know what a huge success he was as manager of Newcastle United. Is the unthinkable possible, do you think? I mean, clearly, you know, one would think maybe you just need to have a London soul in charge of the whole thing.
Well, we're certainly the worst run club in the Premier League, that's
no,
for sure.
No.
I feel almost sorry for John Carver. He is, in fact, I'm told, an outstandingly good coach. And, people like Ruud Gullit say that, and Bobby Robson say that, Keegan rehired him. But there's a difference between being a coach and running a football team.
Well.
You can call the manager of a football team a coach if you want, but the fact is there are different skills involved. And John hasn't had any real experience of that.
But he's
put into a club out in Newcastle, which is probably one of the most difficult clubs to run, because of the owner, basically.
We hear that actually the current chairman of the directors board, Steve, is it Steve? I can't remember. Anyway, so one of this, he assured Mike Ashley that Newcastle stood no chance of relegation.
Yes,
whatsoever.
Apparently. Yes. Yeah. But he's just a servant of the policy. The policy is really done by Mike Ashley. He may not. I mean, obviously, he cannot interfere on a daily basis, but he sets the parameters in which they work. And the fact is that Newcastle sold or got rid of, I think it was two players in January. One was a left back, and the club are trying to say that they got rid of the left back because he was he'd come back from injury and was expecting to go straight back in the first team, and was rather upset that he wasn't automatically put in. The fact, no one believes that up here, but everyone knows that the two other left backs were both perfectly good players. Together wouldn't earn as much as David Sampson did, so he went off to Italy. He's now playing in the Champions League, and Beaver, one of the centre backs, who wasn't particularly good at heading a ball, has gone off to Italy as well. He's been playing in the Champions League. He's not good. They're not good enough for Newcastle United. I mean, it's a joke.
Well,
anyway, sorry, I get irritated by this sort of thing. You might have noticed.
as an Arsenal supporter, Jared,
yeah.
Clearly, you know, for example, you might say Stan Kroenke much better in terms of his sort of input into the whole thing. But any thoughts? Any sympathy with respect to our Newcastle United?
Yeah, I think Newcastle are a great club. I'm not saying that just because
they're great fans.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only great thing about Newcastle is the fans, and they've got a good, very good ground as well, actually.
Yeah.
The rest is absolutely awful. And I mean, don't feel sorry for Newcastle United. Feel sorry for Newcastle United's fans who had to put up with this. I mean, 50,000 people every week.
Ian, may I make a suggestion? Why don't you just go down the A90 a little bit and support Hartlepool? They've survived, you know. So good news there.
I'm going to support Newcastle Falcons next season.
There we are. We have, of course, been chattering about Newcastle United, not because we're against Lincoln City, another mid-table finish.
Yeah, we might beat Lincoln.
Yeah,
Dover. I think the last time we played it, we did beat Lincoln. Actually, we were in the second division.
Actually, Dover Athletic finished higher in the Vanarama Conference than Lincoln City. So interesting.
Who did?
Dover Athletic.
Oh, right, yeah. They're not a bad side, Dover, apparently.
Exactly. It could be the next Bournemouth in a few years' time. You know, who knows what could happen? You know, 10,000. But we'll probably find that in a few weeks' time, there'll be over 100,000 people who say they were at that game, really. But
interesting that, though, that they've got a ground capacity of 12,000.
Yes. Well,
but it's not so important now as it used to be because
TV
of
money.
The television money coming in. Which gives them a chance. Now, if you look at something like Spain, where both Real Madrid and Barcelona negotiate their own TV contracts, what's happened because of that is there's a huge divide between the top three or four clubs in the league and the others, and some of the others would have a championship standard apparently. And if you look at some of the results, Real and Barcelona win about 7 or 8 nothing sometimes.
We have, of course, been filling with talk of association football to allow Jessica to finish the final touches to reading, obviously, the classic Ian Lennox to Gentlemen and Players.
No conversation is long enough, Alex.
No. So, Jessica, how's that been going then?
I'm still prioritising my exams.
Still prioritising her exams, you see. That's very good. Multitasking, of course, is a skill that we fully anticipate you to develop, you know, and we'll work through that. But life
so you prioritise your exams.
It is
more important you read the academic stuff that I've written.
That's why she wasn't on the show last night, because she was putting her work together from the whole sort of package.
Is it your final year?
No, it's my first.
Level
year.
One, first year. So heaven only knows.
Oh, so it doesn't count to your degree then, does it? Oh, that's not fair.
Exactly.
I've just changed my opinion.
So there we have it. No reason whatsoever. It's not like qualification for Europe. Never mind. Have you just slapped something down there, Ian?
The postman's arrived.
Ah, yeah, the famous.
This is live stuff, you know.
The famous Newcastle slapping postman. It's fantastic. It's really dope. Anyway, I think we'll actually invite you to stay around just after the news as well, because we still have to squeeze in the Cameron Tilbury musical selection, because I know you're keen to actually.
All right.
Work through that.
I liked the one last week.
Yeah, it was pretty good, wasn't it?
Well, I could hear you gasping when I said I did.
I was quite surprised. I thought you might have been a bit unwell, but no, it was good. Yeah. Anyway, this week we are actually sort of heading into Sim Bulky territory. I'll say that again, Sim Bulky territory, which is quite interesting because you might have thought, surely someone made a name. I did suggest it might be short for Simon. Cameron didn't seem to have a kind of answer to that at all, really. So I really wasn't sure whether it was a shortened version or whether indeed it's a case of he's a singer, you don't put him in your mobile phone. It could be sort of line from that. But this is going to be coming up in a few seconds' time from now. Jessica's been looking at the delightful photograph of the little dog that you featured with the Batman shadow on your Facebook page, which I thought was splendid from that point of view. And that means that whilst you actually get a cup of coffee or tea, or are you doing a full breakfast for yourself, a full English this morning, Ian?
I got a bit late, so I'm going to wait till after we talk before I cook my breakfast.
Okay, that's fine. Well, you know, in the words of Sim Bulky and the Cameron Tilbury selection, how about we do that tonight?